Hi, this is Paul, and this is Rough Draft for Sunday, where I'm walking through the current version of my Sunday sermon. If you have some input you'd like me to see, some things that you think the sermon could be improved by, or just leave them in the comments section. I'm always curious to know what you think. Jake Angeli is sometimes known as the QAnon shaman. At the anniversary of the storming of the Capitol, an industrious reporter decided to give him an interview by phone over the over a cell phone. It's quite interesting listening to this middle-aged man describe himself and his religious beliefs and what he believed a shaman was and who he believes he is and how he fits into the story of the country and the story of the world. He's very much self-taught, self-authenticated, and now he's doing time for his events on that day. There were hundreds of people who stormed that building, but just putting up his picture, many of you know him. The bison hat, the horns, the flag, all of the various symbols that he had, the tattoos, which he talks about in the interview, how he got them and what they mean for him. His identity, who he is, how we understand him, has everything to do with the place he was at when the pictures were taken. There are pictures of him at other protests and other times around the country, but if there is one figure that will be remembered from this event, it's probably him. Now, it's very interesting because he claims that he is of Native American descent. His grandma once told him that he had Cheyenne blood, and that weaves into his story, and, well, then the story gets strange. How should we understand what happened on that day? Well, it depends a lot on one's perspective. For many, it's an insurgency. Some imagined they were storming it to sort of save the country and not take it over or defeat democracy. With his Native American blood, was he in fact taking it back from the peoples that had taken it from him in the first place? Is this a very distant taking back America? What you see is that even on an event with many pictures and many symbols, that a rush of interpretations flow in, even when all the parties are very much paying attention, and there are congressional hearings, and there are newspaper articles, and many, many, many people were there that day and can tell the story. But figuring out what it means, well, that's a very complex thing. Now, we've begun the Gospel of John, and the Gospel of John is introducing Jesus. The first 18 verses of the first chapter is often called the prologue. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word became flesh. That word is the Greek word logos, and that has a lot of meaning philosophically and has gone through the years. And then we meet John the Baptist. And then, as we saw last week, Jesus draws some disciples from John the Baptist, and he's the Messiah. They understand that he is the one who is going to rescue Israel from its ongoing enslavement to pagan oppressors. That's what we saw 2 weeks ago. Last week, we saw Mary opening the door, in a sense, to Jesus' ministry, pushing him through the door or inviting him through the door and saying, "There's no wine, do something." And Jesus, in fact, provides wine and provides a lot of it. And the signs begin. Now, the first sign, the miracle, is hidden to most, but the slaves and his disciples know what it is, and they begin to trust into him, and they begin to entrust their lives to him. They start to follow him and to live with him, and to bit by bit, they take up the task of discipleship. He will be their model, and they will begin to try to emulate him. Now, the first sign was at his mother's request at the wedding feast at Cana, not too far from where Jesus grew up and where Mary lived and where they had quite a bit of family. The second stop in the Gospel of John is at his father's house. So we go from Jesus flooding a wedding with wine to, well, Jesus acting in his father's house. Now, in the Gospel of John, there are three Passovers recorded, and they are marked by important things that Jesus done. In the first one, he clears the temple. And the second one, he multiplies loaves and fishes in John 6, which is sort of a new Passover. And the third, chapters 18 and 19, he is prepared to be the Passover lamb who takes away the sin of the world. When it was almost time for the Jewish Passover, Jesus went up to Jerusalem. Now, Jesus is about to cleanse the temple, and this has provoked a lot of discussion because, of course, even though the cleansing of the temple is found in all four Gospels, it's located in a very different place in John. And some would say, well, John has simply retold the story, but in a different place for the structure of the book. Others will say that actually this event happened twice, or some aspect of the event happened twice, and therefore it's recorded here. So there's lots of debate over the historical events behind this event. Is it one event or two? Could Jesus have gotten away with it? What on earth does this event mean? If you look at, let's say, the discussion of it in the Gospel of Mark, and then upon which Matthew and Luke build, and the discussion in John, unlike Matthew and Luke, there really isn't much carryover. In the temple courts, he found people selling cattle, sheep, and doves, and others sitting at tables exchanging money. Now, why would this be going on for a major Jewish feast? Jews from all over the world were coming to Jerusalem, and only certain kinds of coins were accepted. So, not coins with images of Caesar on them. So, money would be exchanged, and, well, also if you were coming in and you were going to give the prescribed sacrifices, then you would have to buy the animals. It all seems to be a reasonable accommodation to facilitate the observance of the Jewish feast days for people coming from all over the world. In fact, Jerusalem, in many ways, was its most vibrant economic center was the temple. That was the economic engine of the city. The Jewish population in and around Judea was relatively small compared to the Jewish population that was throughout the Roman world. The Judean and the Galilean populations were relatively poor compared to the populations out there in the broader empire and the much larger cities. So everyone's coming in and they're buying animals for the sacrifices, and they're exchanging money so that they can participate in the feast. So he made a whip out of cords and drove all from the temple courts, both sheep and cattle. He scattered the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables. To those who sold doves, he said, "Get these out of here. Stop turning my father's house into," and the Greek word is an emporium. This is a little different from the synoptics. They quote, "Is it not written, my house will be a house of prayer for all nations, but you have made it a den of robbers." Now, there's a lot of speculation as to, well, what exactly is going on here? It seems a little unreasonable for Jesus to overthrow this particular service that was important for people coming in. And there's discussion as to other places in Jerusalem where the service was being conducted where people could purchase animals or exchange money, and why does it have to be in the court of Gentiles? And if it's in the court of Gentiles, are they in fact pushing out the Gentiles? And there's a lot of discussion about this. One of the questions I think lurks beneath this passage, especially in John, is the question of exchange. Is, in fact, the house of God simply an exchange? Well, much religion is sort of a transaction, sins forgiven by sacrifice. But is this what Jesus is pointing to? Now, there's a quotation that follows next in the Gospel of John, which is important, and it comes from Psalm 69. And as you'll notice, the reference in John is a bit different from the reference in the Synoptic Gospels. His disciples remember that it was written, "Zeal for your house will consume me." Now, this is taken from Psalm 69, and it's worthwhile reading the entire psalm because the context of the psalm might be a little bit surprising, but just the verses around this citation, for I endure scorn for your sake, and shame covers my face. I am a foreigner to my own family, a stranger to my mother's children. For zeal for your house consumes me, and the insults of those who insult you fall on me. And that "you" is being addressed to God. What is this saying about the relationship between Jesus and Jerusalem? In fact, there are a lot of elements here that go into this very complex picture. Jesus very much identifies the temple as his Father's house. He takes ownership of it in order to purify it, but he knows full well that those of his own family, those of his own people, are going to reject him. And he is claiming that he is going to be rejected for the sake of his faithfulness to his Father, whose house he is cleansing. For I endure scorn for your sake, and shame covers my face. I am a foreigner to my own family, a stranger to my own mother's children. For zeal for your house consumes me, and the insults of those who insult you fall on me. Now, as we're going to see in a few verses from now, some of these reflections and citations are going to be connected to not just Jesus in the moment, but in fact, the entire narrative arc of his ministry. Now, sort of like QAnon by the Capitol, drawing all the attention to himself, Jesus is doing something that will certainly get attention. In fact, over the years, many scholars have asked, is the story made up? How could Jesus get away with this? They have temple guards that surely would have stopped him and arrested him. This is to such a degree that even one, an early church father, Origen, claimed that this is a miracle that should be set alongside other miracles that Jesus did. The leaders then responded to him, "What signs can you show us to prove your authority to do all of this?" And in that way, you sort of see QAnon wearing the bison horns, carrying a flag, carrying a drum, doing all of these. These, he imagined, were his signs of authority. And in many respects, they're looking to Jesus, well, you're taking the temple into your hand. The temple is not yours to take. We have leaders and priests and guards and all of those to occupy the temple, not to give it up to people who come in to do violence to it. Please show us your credentials, sir. Now, Jesus, what he is doing is a demonstration of his location in Israel's story and therefore the world story. Last week we saw that changing water to wine very much set him within the motif of the vineyard and God's care for Israel. Jesus is the bridegroom who will bring the earth story to a glorious fulfillment. That's in the water to wine. Now here, he is the King of the Jews who will bring Israel's story to glorious fulfillment. In fact, action in the temple is about, and this is clear in the other synoptic descriptions of the cleansing of the temple as well, is in fact a replacement. So they asked him, "What sign can you show us to prove your authority to do this?" Jesus answered them, "Destroy this temple, and I will raise it again in 3 days." Now it's helpful to know that this particular building was constructed after the Babylonian exile, when the Persians gave the Jews permission and money to return and rebuild the temple. And for 46 years, Herod the Great, who in fact, by working on the temple and restoring the temple and expanding the temple, had his own messianic ambitions that he was working. He very much wanted to be embraced by the Jews, this is Herod the Great, as a Messiah figure, but he was never accepted. He was looked upon basically as a tool of the Romans, which in very many ways he was. He knew that his political supremacy relied on his ties to Rome. "Destroy this temple and I will raise it again in 3 days. They replied, "It has taken 46 years to build this temple, and you are going to raise it in 3 days?" They asked for a sign, and in a sense, what Jesus points to them is, but the temple he had spoken of was his body. The sign was his body, and he said, "Destroy this temple, which they will do, and I will raise it again in 3 days." He's clearly pointing to the resurrection. By the signs they entrusted themselves into him, his disciples did. By the resurrection, they began to believe the scriptures and his words too. Verse 22, after he was raised from the dead, his disciples recalled what he had said. Then they believed the scriptures and the words that Jesus had spoken. You can see the transformation that is underway, and in fact, in this verse, we can see something of the timeline of the transformation. The disciples, it seems, follow Jesus and are sort of being impressed by him and confused by him, and it really isn't until after everything has happened, after the temple, his body, has been destroyed, after he's raised from the dead on the third day, that everything starts to click into place. And notice, it's not just belief in him, it's belief in the scriptures that they believe point to him. And in fact, the entire process of Christianity and its basis begins to come together. They begin to trust in him at Cana with the miracle of water to wine. And then here with this miracle, the process of not only believing in him, but seeing his alignment with the scriptures and the truth of his own words all comes together. Now, while he was in Jerusalem at the Passover festival, many people saw the signs he was performing and believed in his name. So in other words, in Cana, the servants knew, the disciples knew, Mary knew, but hardly anyone else. Now, at his father's house in Jerusalem, more and more people are beginning to believe. They're beginning to think that he is something special. He is the Messiah. He will save us. But again, what that messiahship means, well, that we're going to have to look at. But Jesus would not entrust himself to them, for he knew all people. He did not need any testimony about mankind. In fact, all of this is about him, but he didn't need to know about them, for he knew what was in each person. In other words, he was quite lonely. He, in many ways, embodied what was happening in Psalm 69. They didn't understand him. They didn't know who he was. They didn't understand why he was doing what he was doing. But he understood them, and he would bring it to completion. Even for Jake Angeli, who he is in the world was created by showing up at a place, at a time, and taking some action. He wore a strange costume, he got his picture taken, he got arrested, and even today he gets interviewed and people wonder at what he says. Is he right? Is he true? Are his ideas right? Are his ideas true? Well, time tells. Do we believe his words? Well, you can listen to the interview and decide which of his words you in fact do believe. History is remarkably difficult to make sense of. What happened on January 6? Was it an attempt to overthrow the government? Was it an attempt to take back the government? What in fact is the government? If you have Native American blood and you put on a bison hat and you embrace the flag and you get tattoos when your father dies, well, does that make you king? If you're in the building, if you're in the Senate chamber, if you're there in front having your picture taken by a table, does that make you head of the government? How would you know? How would you tell? How will he be viewed 100 years from now? Will he be remembered? My guess is no. Will this incident be remembered? That's remarkably difficult to know. For example, when John Brown took possession of the armory at Harper's Ferry, today we look back on that as a precursor for the Civil War. That's because the Civil War happened, and that's because we're looking at history through history back to the events, and, well, they all sort of line up. But from this perspective, this might just be sort of a strange man with all kinds of kooky ideas who's now serving time in jail for the things he did on January 6 a year ago. From the first personal perspective, it's really hard to tell. At the moment Jesus did what he did, probably some thought he was nuts. Many thought, I'm sure, he was dangerous. Others looked at him and said, wow, someone's finally standing up and doing the right thing. Which is the truth? Well, even today, people will differ on who Jesus is and what he was doing and whether or not that was really his Father's house. True authority is always manifest in time. The Second Temple, that I believe when Jesus was doing this, especially in the Synoptics, he was prophesying that the temple would be destroyed. And in 70 AD, it was destroyed and has never been rebuilt. His body as temple, however, has been remaking the world for 2,000 years. John introduces Jesus to us. What sign can you show us to prove your authority to do this? The sign on the top of the cross in three languages said, Jesus, King of the Jews. Who was he? What did he do? Well, we're still talking about him, and it's 2,000 years later. And the number of people who believe in him and entrust themselves to him continues to grow. History is full of strange stories. Stories with bizarre characters that seem crazy, wrong, and insane. The vast majority of these are seen to be crazy, wrong, and insane, and mostly forgotten. But Jesus is a very interesting case. Back to Tom Holland's quote, because Tom Holland hadn't been thinking much about Jesus until he started to study it, and he says this in a podcast. Imagine you've got to write a story in which, for the first time, someone who suffers the excruciating death of a slave is going to be cast as being, in some way, part of the Creator God who fashioned everything, and he's got to be convincing, not just to people now, but for 2,000 years and across the whole span of the world. It's really an astonishing thing to have pulled off as a literary feat, and that four people did it is amazing. And again, the one thing the four people have in common is their subject, Jesus. I really don't think 2,000 years from now, the QAnon shaman will have the same status. This story, however, is foundational for more than we realize. The question we have to ask ourselves is how will we respond to it?